We are joined tonight by an old friend who's been here a few times before, Ron Rosenbaum, who, to my mind, is one of the most interesting, serious journalists in the country. He writes regularly for the New York Observer, and he's done all sorts of magazine pieces on many really quite diverse subjects. But in recent years, he has inevitably been drawn into the examination of modern history as it bears upon the fate of the Jews. His book, Explaining Hitler, which we discussed here some years ago, was a masterwork. And now a new one has just been published, this one edited by Ron Rosenbaum with a very strong and involving introduction. The book is titled Those Who Forget the Past, The Question of Anti-Semitism. But of course you are invoking Santayana's almost too famous dictum, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it.
Well, it was... People can project a number of corollaries to those who forget the past. I think the one I was thinking of most particularly was obviously the Holocaust and how the situation of the Jews today in Israel is imperiled to some extent similarly of the Jews in Germany in the 30s. There are those who believe that there is no good way out, and that, in fact, if we don't learn the lesson of the past, we may be forced to see a repetition of the tragedy of the 1940s.
You stirred up a lot of attention and a lot of debate with a crucial article in the New York Observer on the possibility of a second Holocaust.
It was as if I were uttering the forbidden taboo phrase. It was a phrase that I found, actually, in a Philip Roth novel, Operation Shylock, which he wrote in 1993, and he put in the mouth of one of his characters, and as we all know, Philip Roth often puts his own thoughts in the mouth of his characters, and this character said, look, Israel was a great solution for the Jews after World War II, but at this point, surrounded by people who want to kill them, who want to drive the Israelis into the sea, Israel is threatened by a second Holocaust. And I mentioned that. The column I was actually writing was in some ways more about European anti-Semitism, how I was trying to explain how European anti-Semitism of the current day was a response to the Holocaust, that Europeans had long lived with the burden of guilt for their complicity with Hitler in the Holocaust. Hitler didn't do it alone. He needed the entire continent of Europe to murder the Jews. And finally, the Europeans are able to shed the burden of shame, shed the burden of guilt by saying, look at those Israelis, they're behaving badly. Maybe the Jews were bad after all. Maybe we don't have to feel as guilty as we used to do. But in any case, I guess what I was talking about was the way this kind of response delegitimized the Jewish state, left it without any of the support that even Philip Roth imagined for it back in 1993, that the whole world was turning against the Jewish state, and often on the basis of lies.
I am very aware of a portion of the whole world, a small portion, but the one to which I belong, having turned against the Jewish state. And that portion is American university professors. Not all of them, but the American academic community, particularly in the humanities and the social sciences. Physicists are too busy doing serious things to perhaps be all that involved in these matters. But as you well know, and there are articles in this anthology that you've put together which deal with it, the American professoriate has become virtually a tool, or at least a mouthpiece, for Al-Aqsa and worse.
It's really shocking to me, actually, because, you know, when you think back to Hitler and his helpers, the Croatians and all that, these are people who seem to be ancient barbarians, but these professors are people I know. They're people I grew up with.
They're people I've worked with for a long, long time.
And the fact that professors could have such a double standard, could choose to ignore the historical context of the situation of the Jewish state and only see one side of the question, is deeply shocking to me. I have a theory about particularly one aspect of the left and why they have adopted this view. And it has something to do with Holocaust denial. I have a theory that the left has not resolved the fact that it did nothing, it cared little, it expressed no outrage while Marxist genocides were going on in the Soviet Union, in China, in Cambodia, and their view of the hierarchy of evil in the world is thus skewed. They've always wanted to believe that the United States is the most evil nation on the face of the earth, and by ignoring, treating with equanimity or indifference the evil of Marxist regimes, America still remains to them the greatest evil, and those countries allied with America, such as the State of Israel, get this knee-jerk response of being equally somehow evil.
Yet you identify yourself in the introductory chapter of the new book, Those Who Forget the Past. You identify yourself, just to use standard terminology, as a, quote, liberal Democrat.
I've always been a liberal Democrat.
Are you still?
My parents were FDR Democrats. I was a JFK Democrat. Domestically, I still feel like a liberal Democrat. I have to say I'm shocked by the confused, ambivalent response of many on the left, certainly, to 9/11. And I think 9/11 was really a turning point in the evolution of contemporary anti-Semitism.
In fact, you drew an interesting typology of three types of anti-Semitism: pre-Holocaust anti-Semitism, post-Holocaust anti-Semitism, and post 9/11. Explain the difference between, or the difference and continuity between those three.
Well, you know, I recently spoke at a screening of the movie Gentleman's Agreement, and
really the old
Gregory Peck movie. It was made in 1947, but it was really about pre-war America.
Sure.
And the the most blatant anti-Semitism that he experienced was being snubbed by a snooty hotel reservationist or turned down by a country club set, that sort of thing. So that's, in America anyway, pre-war anti-Semitism. Post-war, post-Holocaust anti-Semitism is different. It's stained, it's tainted by the fact of Hitler's crime. So it's not the same to make jokes about Jews or slurs about Jews post-Holocaust, because in fact you now realize that the culture of prejudice against Jews is part of a spectrum that Hitler was at the very far end of. So then we come to 9/11. And to me, the tip-off after 9/11, almost in the very few hours after 9/11, was the rumor, and I'm sure you've heard it, that 4,000 Jews or Israelis were told by Israeli intelligence, the Mossad, to stay home from the World Trade Center that day because the Mossad, of course, the Israelis, had engineered the 9/11 attacks. And this rumor flew around the world, leapt into cyberspace, and is believed now by hundreds of millions of people.
And it was further elaborated that it was the Mossad that actually did the assault and knocked down the towers.
There are various versions of it. Yes, some say the Mossad flew the planes, for all we know. There are different versions. Now, in America, it's believed mainly by conspiracy theorists. But in most of the rest of the world, hundreds of millions do. And what it said to me was that something bad happens the Jews are going to be blamed for it. And it also had another interesting twist to it, I think. It seemed to me a kind of downsized version of Holocaust denial. The 4,000 missing Jews were like the 6 million who supposedly did not die in the Holocaust. And it shows how Holocaust denial, which we think of as a crude, ridiculous joke, nonetheless has embedded itself in the consciousness of anti-Semites.
There are many who buy what the Holocaust deniers purvey and really believe that that they've got a purchase on the secret, the hidden truth, that very few Jews were really killed by the Nazis. But you say in this book, just as a side issue, but it's a fascinating assertion on your part, that it's quite clear that the leading Holocaust deniers don't believe what they're saying. They're doing it with total cynicism.
You know, I think that There's a very interesting book, a testimony of a former skinhead neo-Nazi.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah, who said that, you know, we play concentration camp, gas chamber games in private, and we deny the Holocaust in public. But then you have an interesting case like Hutton Gibson, Mel Gibson's father, who is a Holocaust denier through and through, and I think is foolish enough to actually believe it. I think there's a greater wickedness in perpetrating it cynically while knowing that you're perpetrating a lie. Well, Hutton Gibson has now elaborated his view of Holocaust denial. He actually accuses the Jews of making a deal with Hitler to fake the Holocaust, get the Jews to Israel or to other places, and to And interestingly, in the anthology, Frank Rich, who published a piece on Mel Gibson and Hutton Gibson, because Mel Gibson threatened to put Frank Rich's intestines on a stake for daring to raise some questions about the movie The Passion. In any case, there's a previously unpublished transcript of an interview with Hutton Gibson in which he says these amazing things, plus, he says, the purpose of The Passion was to remind people that that the Jews faked the Holocaust, but they were really there at the crucifixion.
That's the father.
That's the father, uh-huh. Hutton Gibson. Yeah.
Well, how has the son reacted to that?
The son has failed to repudiate his father, and I don't know if you remember the Diane Sawyer interview with Mel Gibson.
I do.
It was
fascinating
because she had to ask him, she had to practically beg him to say that the Holocaust happened, and he said, "Well, I know a lot of people were casualties, and I saw Taylor who had a tattoo on his wrist, so he tried to make it sort of a part of the general devastation of World War II."
Some commercials coming in a moment. I want to remind you of a famous, bitter, funny story. You've heard it many times. A Nazi in Germany, just at the beginning of the war, is walking down the street. He sees an old Jewish gentleman. He knocks him off the sidewalk. And then he says, "Jew, who is responsible for the war?" And the Jew answers, as you know, "The bicycles and the Jews." And the Nazi says, "Why the bicycles?" And the famous response is, "Why the Jews?" I put to you the question, why the Jews? Not merely now, but what view do you have on the total history of and the origins of and the persistence of anti-Semitism in the history of the world over the last 2,000 years. We return to Ron Rosenbaum, drawing from his new book, the book that he's edited and for which he's written a very significant, long introductory chapter, Those Who Forget the Past, The Question of Anti-Semitism, which has just been published by Random House. Directly back after this. And we return to Ron Rosenbaum. We're drawing from his new book, Those Who Forget the Past, The Question of Anti-Semitism. That book, edited with an introduction by Ron Rosenbaum and with many other significant authors represented in this anthology. That book is just published by Random House. It's a question which has exercised many, many people, sociologists, philosophers, historians. What is the source of anti-Semitism? Why the Jews? Not merely in this latter day, not merely during that slum of a century, the 20th, but rather over the last 20 centuries.
not an easy question, Milt. You could say Christianity accept that anti-Semitism was present in the ancient world before Christianity. However, the early Christian religion, when Paul became its prime mover, did wish to define itself against Jews, against its Jewish origin. And there was a faction of Christianity, the anti-Judaizers, that became dominant and was responsible in a way for many of the anti-Jewish elements.
It's in Paul. It's also in the last of the canonical Gospels. It's in John.
Yes.
But not in Matthew, Mark, and Luke particularly.
That's right. It's a sort of a late part of the early stage of Christianity.
Yeah.
But it took over and it became an extreme kind of... However, Christianity isn't the only source. I mean, there is the scapegoat theory, which is everyone is familiar with. But George Steiner actually came up with a really interesting theory, I thought. I'm not sure if I buy it entirely, but he said, the world has always resented the Jews because the phrase he used was the blackmail of transcendence, three impossible demands that three Jews made on humanity. Moses demanded complete obedience, Jesus demanded perfect love, and Marx demanded perfect justice. And fallible human beings couldn't live up to it and resented the fact that these Jews made these demands on them. I don't know. It tends toward a blame the victims argument. I mean, these are not bad demands to make. You know, why blame the Jews for aspiring highly for humanity? I think, you know, when I was just making some notes now, I was just thinking it has a lot to do with the fact that Jews are and have wanted to be a people apart. They don't try to convert people. They don't seek to, evangelize. They're happy being who are. But that causes suspicion. And also, they have never had, up until the founding of the state of Israel, any land of their own. So, of course, they're not only a people apart, but they're a wandering people. And so it's easy to accuse them, like in the Middle Ages, of the plague or subsequently of other... any bad thing that happens to happen if Jew wanders nearby is going to be blamed on him. And Jews hoped, that was the dream of the state of Israel, that it would put an end to anti-Semitism because Jews would have a land of their own, they wouldn't be wandering, people would let them alone to be Jews. It hasn't worked out that way.
It hasn't worked out that way, and in fact, one necessarily then has to ask, what has the establishment of Israel and the way in which Israel is played its search for security in a very, very dangerous neighborhood, namely certainly the 67 war and the taking of the West Bank and the continued occupation of the West Bank and of Gaza, the Gaza Strip. What has all of that done to further arouse the Arab world and then more broadly diffusing through all of the Muslim world? What has that done to arouse them against the Zionist entity, against the Zionists, and then led them towards the easy equation of Zionism with Jews and Judaism and lumping it all in one basket, which is to be totally disdained and because of the continued frustration in the Arab cause or in the Palestinian cause, it has escalated higher and higher into a state of rage, which is shared apparently now through all of the Muslim world.
And
we're just having much influence on the Europeans, who are not Muslims, who are now learning it from that those large populations of Muslims who have established themselves in Paris, in Madrid, in London, and so on.
I know, and I think the European aspect of it is in some way the most troubling. I mean, it's a tragedy of history that the remnants of the Jews who weren't murdered by the Europeans had no place to go. But Palestine, no place would let them in. No place would let them in while they were being killed. UN declarations gave them a state. And there were Arab people living there. And they would not recognize the right of the Jews to live peacefully, coexistently. And ever since the Jewish state was born, it has there have been one after another war to exterminate it. And that is the history that is sort of left out when people talk about the occupation of the West Bank. You know, the state of Israel didn't seek to occupy the West Bank. The state of Israel was once again, for the third time, in a war with neighbors that wanted to drive it into the sea.
They were at the receiving end of yet another invasion.
Exactly. Yeah. They won that war. They had the territory. They tried to make a peace deal to give it back, but that peace deal would have involved one simple thing: their Arab neighbors recognizing the right of the state of Israel to exist. And the Arab neighbors would not do that. And so what are the Jews in Israel to do? Give it back to people who want to drive them into the sea? And I don't think anyone in Israel wanted to oversee an occupation. They want peace like everyone else.
That's your view. In fact, it's also my view. But when I look at what the Western press does with the daily flow of events and tragedy in the Middle East, it seems to me that our reporters, our editorialists in the main, have a very different perception of it all.
I think there's an incredible double standard, a moral relativity. I mean, look at what's happening in Gaza today. It's in the headlines, so let's discuss that.
Yes, indeed.
What are the Israelis doing? For years and years, the southern border of Gaza borders on Egypt, and there's a town that straddles the border, and that town has been a means by which explosives, deadly weapons, are smuggled from Arab countries into Palestinian territories, and the Palestinians then use them to blow up women and children. It's not to attack the Israeli military. They use them to indiscriminately slaughter families. And the Israelis are finally taking action to close down these tunnels for smuggling the weapons that have been killing their families. They're not doing this because they desire to cause trouble, to injure Palestinians. They're doing it because this has been a constant source of death for their families, and they're trying to take action.
A Palestinian advocate or somebody loyal to that general point of view or impressed by that point of view would counter what you've just said by a simple statistical point. The fact is, more Palestinians, I think it's about a 2-to-1 ratio, have been killed in these years of struggle than have Israelis.
I'm not sure of the figures, but I know that the targets of the Palestinians have been indiscriminately women and children, while the Israeli army has gone out of its way to avoid civilian casualties. I mean, look at Jenin, which was when the Israeli army went into Jenin, which was the source of suicide bombings, and particularly the one of Passover 2002, when 29 worshippers were blown up. They took
On Passover.
Yeah. They took great care not to injure civilians, despite the fact that houses were booby-trapped, that civilians were being used as shields. There were 52 Palestinians, most of them combatants, killed in that operation. And yet, throughout the world press, it was spread about that there were mass graves, there were thousands killed, there were indiscriminate murders by the Israelis, when in fact they did everything they could to target only combatants. And if there are more, by some margin, Palestinian combatants killed, I would wager that the percentage of those killed on the Palestinian side is more active combatants, while the percentage killed on the Israeli side is more women and children.
There is the overview that one gets from Ramallah or from any other Arab capital, which is the Zionists are really the new Nazis, and they are murderous, and they are persecuting the Arab peoples, not only the Palestinians, and they are a danger to the peace and decency of the world. That's one view. And the opposite view, which is easily enunciated by many, but not by all Israelis, is that we are an embattled minority in this vast area, and our life depends upon our holding off those who want to kill us. And they still want to kill us, and it gets more and more fierce, and we have to be constantly militant until at last reason dawns, and they sit down and negotiate seriously a real settlement, which we are ready to do. Those are the two views. Why is it, I raise this question again, just as we sneak away for some commercials, why is it that the Palestinian view has predominated in the last year or two, or longer, in the West, and in those American academies, and in most of the American news sources, and certainly in the countries of Western Europe, in their press, in their academies, and in the popular opinion as measured by the usual pollsters? Those questions need address. That's the new wave of anti-Zionism, which has become anti-Semitism because it has ramifications also with regard to general disdain for Jews. A new way of falsifying the nature of the Jewish community now prevails in many of those circles, intellectual and diffusing from the intellectuals through the masses of Western Europe and of this country. So why has that worked more than the counter view propounded by some very effective spokesmen for the Israeli cause and for the Jewish communities of the world? That's the question I stick you with. Looking forward to your answer after these words. And again, our guest for the evening is Ron Rosenbaum, one of the really distinguished American journalists. His columns, his articles, every other week in the New York Observer, which is a wonderful special newspaper published, obviously, in New York and is available regularly on the Internet as well, are always readable, always fascinating. And his book of a few years ago, which we discussed on this program, Explaining Hitler, is a classic. It's a study of, and based upon interviews with, many scholars who've attempted to make sense out of the Holocaust and the basic question of how and why it happened, and ultimately trying to make sense out of what motivated Hitler and what really was the nature of the obsessions that moved him, and for that matter, what were the secrets of his life that might have had something to do with his becoming the prime anti-Semite, the murderous anti-Semite of our time, or of that time, now 50 years ago or more. His new book, of which he is the editor and for which he's written a brilliant introduction, is titled Those Who Forget the Past, The Question of Anti-Semitism, Random House, the publishers. The question I was posing a moment ago is, why has the anti-Israeli view shaded off into, beyond anti-Zionism, into true anti-Semitism? Why has that prevailed in the West rather than the counter view propounded by the defenders of Israel and the defenders of the Jewish people?
Well, I think one factor which particularly holds true in Europe, one of the essayists in my book, Melanie Phillips, calls it Holocaust inversion. And it comes from, she's referring to the use of Nazi metaphors applied to the state of Israel, like Tom Paul and the poet call the Zionist SS, or some people call Jenin and Auschwitz. A maddening lie. But nonetheless, it salves the European conscience, which was so deeply embedded with Hitler in perpetrating the Holocaust, that to be able to call the Jews Nazis gives some sort of sick satisfaction. Now, why it's also this Nazi, this Holocaust inversion, the Nazi imagery, takes an even more concrete form in the Middle East, where throughout the Middle East, Hitler's books are being reprinted. Mein Kampf is a bestseller. Holocaust denial is very popular.
The Protocols of the Elders of Zion is celebrated.
Exactly.
That famous Egyptian television series based upon the protocol.
41-part TV show based upon this terrible but influential forgery, which claimed the Jewish cabal is running everything.
Interesting side note, worth mentioning. You do mention it in your book. The protocols were put aside in many ways. They were worked up by Tsarist agents in the 19th century. They had their time. They were sort of forgotten and put aside until revived and popularized by, of all people, Henry Ford.
Henry Ford was...
And you could argue that Henry Ford helped bring Hitler about.
Hitler was one of Henry Ford's biggest fans, particularly because Henry Ford serialized in his newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, in the early 20s, this deeply anti-Semitic forgery, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It was translated into German. Hitler and the Nazi Party spread it all over. And in fact, if you read Mein Kampf, you see how Hitler cribbed from Henry Ford. Henry Ford was one of the most powerful influences on Adolf Hitler. He had a statue of Henry Ford in Nazi Party offices in Munich before he came to power. It's just all the more ironic to see this, the fact that someone said, there was quite a brilliant article by Omer Bartov in the New Republic recently, in which he said, yes, Hitler is dead, but Hitlerism lives on. And what still I don't, Milt, have a really good answer for you on why this has an appeal for Western academics, except for the residual blindness of Marxism, the knee-jerk belief that anyone who is against America or poses as an underdog, but poses as an underdog, the state of Israel, with its 6 million people, 5 million Jews, is surrounded by 300 million Muslims who are preached at constantly by mullahs and imams, and who are read constant stream of hate literature against the Jews, whose organizations are not dedicated to a peaceful solution, a two-state solution of the Palestinian situation, which is what the Israelis have asked for since day one.
That's what they thought they got in the Oslo Agreement.
That's what, right. But in fact, everyone from Arafat to Hamas knew that was a joke, that that was step one to wiping out the state of Israel, and it's basically official policy of every Palestinian organization at this point. To see the Palestinians as underdogs while the Jews are fighting for their life on a sliver of land is just it's a denial of reality. It's a denial of reality on the level of Holocaust denial.
The Jews are a complex people, and though it is thought from the outside that they maintain inner solidarity, the fact is they don't necessarily at all. The fact is there is much division within the broad Jewish realm with regard to some of the essential issues. What I have in mind particularly, where I'm leading you, and because I can't explain this, and again I'm looking to you, the great explainer of Hitler, to explain to me, I won't call it Jewish anti-Semitism, but I'll call it Jewish deviationism of a sort that is unnerving and is almost intended perhaps to injure the sensibilities of one's brethren. What I have in mind particularly are those Jewish intellectuals. There are many in Israel, and there are a few in this country, who have written not only against the state of Israel, but have also begun to be critical of and in some ways condescending towards the memory of the Holocaust and the what they label, quote, the Holocaust industry. The man who I think coined that term, Norman Finkelstein, is an historian of some sort, who only within the last year or two was brought to this town to take a position at DePaul University.
It's fascinating to me. When I was on the left as a youth, we had this term, internalizing the values of the oppressor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was how certain people, when faced with an oppressor or an enemy, would somehow find a way to find virtues in that enemy. It made life much easier. I think there's that. I think on the left there's also, not to be underestimated, the dinner party factor. When Leon Wieseltier, and he and I have had our differences, but he did a brilliant dissection of Tony Jute, J-U-T,
Jute is a professor of political science at NYU. Wieseltier is the literary editor of the New Republic.
Right, and Jute had written an article for the New York Review of Books calling for, essentially, for the dissolution of the Jewish state. And Wieseltier talked about how Jude had brought up the notion of shame, but really what he meant by shame was the difficulty that Jude must have had at left-wing dinner parties, defending, you know, or being the Jew there, or feeling resentful that he had to defend the state of Israel. One should not underestimate the power either of internalizing the values of the oppressor or the power of the dinner party. As for the Holocaust industry and all that, it's a very fascinating phenomenon, and I would call it a kind of widespread backlash against the Holocaust. The Holocaust is something that's unbearable to hold in your mind. People want to escape it. There are various ways of escaping it. One could say that, the Holocaust happened, but it shouldn't have any real consequences. It shouldn't have any consequences for the state of Israel. The fact that Hitler said he was going to destroy the Jews and went about doing it. Israel is surrounded by 300 million people who are in large measure led spiritually and otherwise politically by people who want to destroy the Jews. We shouldn't make any comparisons, Holocaust comparisons. I call this Holocaust inconsequentiality. There's also Holocaust, I've heard the phrase Holocaust fatigue, Holocaust industry. My view is that, yes, it is unbearable, but in fact, we have only really begun to assimilate, to understand the lessons for human nature of the Holocaust, and that it's a little too early and a little too easy to turn against it, to blame the victims, and I think that's what's going on.
I must pick up on a phrase you've just uttered and ask you to clarify, and in this I speak for my audience. You just said Israel surrounded by 300 million who want to destroy the Jews. Now, does one mean that literally? Do we have, and looking at the leadership of the Muslim world, because when you speak of 300 million, you're talking about the Arab world, basically.
I'm talking about basically
the Middle Eastern world.
I'm including Iran. Well, if you look at the charter of Hamas, it calls for the death of the Jews. If
you look at the Jews or the disestablishment of the state of Israel?
No, death of the Jews. Quotes a Quranic verse that calls for every Jew hiding behind a tree shall be killed. Omar Bartov cites this in his New Republic article. And then you have preachers in the Islamic world, state-sponsored preachers, who say this. They say, they address Hitler. They say, oh, my brother Hitler, if only it were true that the Holocaust happened, we would worship you. Or, oh, brother Hitler, you didn't finish the job. There is Hitlerism rife.
These are imams on Friday giving their sermons, and they're often carried on national television, even in Egypt, certainly in Iran and places like that. But what about the political leadership?
I don't see a lot of courage in the political leadership. I mean,
we don't think that Mubarak is, or do we?
Well, that is the deal.
Committed to the extermination of the Jews?
That is basically the deal that Mubarak has made, that he will allow these preachers who say, murder the Jews, their freedom to say that, as long as they allow Mubarak to stay in power. And it's the deal that the Saudi government has made. It's a deal all these backward Arab dictators have made with the Jew haters who preach from the mosques. And
who...
The stream.
And who exert deep influence upon the mass, do you think?
And it's in the textbooks. I mean, a turning point for me on this issue was the question of incitement in Palestinian textbooks.
Yeah.
I was a liberal. I was a supporter of the Oslo peace process. I believed in it until a certain point in 1996 when Benjamin Netanyahu was getting flack from all over the world and from Israelis as well, because he didn't want to take the next step in the Oslo peace process, give back more land to the Palestinians, until the Palestinians lived up to this part of the agreement, the part of the Oslo agreement that called for them to take the incitement to hate Jews out of Palestinian textbooks. So a whole generation of Palestinian children wouldn't be brought up hating Jews.
We come to the point at which the question must be raised. It's Vladimir Ilyich Lenin's great question. What is to be done, if anything can be done? And I look forward to your response on that after we pause for these words. And we return to Ron Rosenbaum in just a moment after I now invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines. We'll be on to the phones in about 15 minutes at the most. And the number, of course, is, as ever, 591-7200. 591-7200. And if you're up quite early in Amman or in Tehran and listening to us on the Internet and want to join this conversation, the easiest way would be via email. The email address is extension720@tribune.com. extension720@tribune.com or 591-7200. Get your calls or emails in. We'll be with you shortly. And I restate the question, what is to be done, if anything can be done?
You know, this is where I get in trouble. Just this week, I have a piece in the Observer, the New York Observer, which is, I guess you might call, a pessimist manifesto, in which I say, I grew up as an American thinking that all problems would have a solution. You know, just people of goodwill had to get together and listen to reason, and sooner or later, there would be a solution. I'm not sure I see a solution in the Middle East.
You've written a pessimistic piece, you say.
Yes.
And I must quote to you Golda Meir, once the Prime Minister of Israel, who said, pessimism is a luxury that a Jew never can allow himself.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, Golda. wherever you are, I just don't see an answer. There's a... I seek it from everyone. It's funny. Jeffrey Goldberg, the great reporter for The New Yorker, who's done a lot of very brave reporting for the Middle East, told this joke, which I probably won't repeat as well as he did, but it was about some shtetl Jews who were about to be thrown out of town by their overlords. And the rabbi made a deal with the chief overlord. He said, let us stay one more year. If you let us stay one more year, I'll teach your dog to talk. And the overlord said, you teach my dog to talk? All right, one more year. And the rabbi went back to the congregation and said, I've got a deal. I've got one more year. The only catch is I've got to teach the overlord's dog to talk. And the Jew said, well, what do you mean? You'll never be able to do that. He said, well, we've got a year. Who knows? You know, basically, that's the most optimistic vision I can do. That this horrible, horrible situation may not escalate to apocalyptic proportions. I don't see any peace deal emerging.
Speaking of apocalyptic proportions, there's something that you quote in your introduction to the new book, to Those Who Forget the Past, which I had not encountered before. And it's the ultimate apocalyptic prospect. It goes to a speech given by Rafsanjani, the imam who was for a number of years the main man in Iran.
He was, as they say, spiritual leader of Iran. And he said, we don't care whether Israel has nuclear weapons. when we get nuclear weapons and there happens to be a nuclear exchange between Iran and Israel, we in Iran might lose 15 million people, but there are a billion Muslims. Meanwhile, the 5 million Jews of Israel will be wiped out. That kind of chillingly cold-blooded rhetoric.
Do you take that as a statement of a programmatic intention?
I hope not, but, expecting the best is not necessarily a good guide to behavior in the Middle East. Expecting that people are talking in metaphors. So when people invoke Hitler and say, if only you'd finished the job. Well, again, I cite Omar Bartov because he said this very well. When people say they are going to do evil and they have the means to do evil, one thing that Hitler taught us is that they will do evil.
What could be done at the propagandistic level, or shall we say at the communication level, or at the re-education level, with regard to the opinion in the West? You're trying to do something. You write about these things.
I guess. I don't know how much difference it will make. I think there are There is one optimistic sign that, back in 2002, there was a big debate. Should Jews speak out or not? And there were some Jews who said, don't speak out. That's ethnic panic. Be quiet. It was an echo of the debate that happened before World War II, where some Jewish organization said, let's not speak out against Hitler. It will make us too conspicuous. But some Jews did speak out. And it to a certain extent, there has been some progress. And the one concrete thing I would cite was the April 29th declaration by the 55 foreign ministers of the European Security Coordination Group in Geneva. And what they said was very important. They said that anti-Zionism, hatred of Israel, hatred of Israel's policies, is not an excuse for anti-Semitism. Now, before this, the French, for instance, had said, when Muslim youth had trashed Jewish synagogues, beat up Jews, they had basically said their unofficial / official policy was, well, they're reacting to anger to what's happening in Palestine. These 55 foreign ministers said, no, that's not an excuse. It's anti-Semitism to attack Jews, and whatever you feel about the situation in the Middle East, it's not an excuse. And I don't think that would have happened if Jews in America, Jews in Europe, Jews all over the world had not shamed the Europeans into taking this step. Shamed them because basically saying to them, oh no, you cannot just throw off the shame of the Holocaust so soon. You cannot just forget the past. You cannot just suddenly be indifferent to the fate of the Jews.
Many of our listeners undoubtedly have rather strong views on this basic question, on the question of Israel. And many of our listeners probably tend to buy, in general, the anti-Israeli or the anti-Likud or the anti-Sharon line. I wonder how they are responding to what you're saying. Yet other of our listeners, of course, would tend to agree with you, and they're not only the Jewish listeners, but yet others. But I mention that because I'd love to hear from those who agree and those, surely, who disagree. If you're hearing something that tends to shake your general negative disposition towards the current Israeli government and its policies, do by all means join in the conversation. The number is 591-7200. Whether you're seeking a simple answer to a question or whether you have a view you want to express, and whether that view accords or discords with the views that Ron Rosenbaum is expressing and which I heartily support, do by all means give us a call. The lines are open. We await your calls. 591-7200. If you want to join in this conversation, now's the time to move because we will be on to the phones in just a few minutes. 591-7200. Something we haven't directly discussed, but a number of the people in this volume that you've edited do advert to it. The Islamicization, if one might call it that, of Europe. It's happening.
Well, a lot of people have explained the indifference of the European governments or the hostility of the European governments to Israel, to the fact that, for instance, in France, I'm not sure of the exact figure, but it's moving towards 20% of the population mm-hmm. are Muslims, and demographically that segment is growing faster, as it's true in many other.
And the birth rate, the replacement rate for native groups, whether in France or in Italy or Spain, is virtually below replacement level.
That's right. And so I think
so the Muslim population is expanding tremendously as the Christian population is diminishing.
Right. Not that the Christian population is to
Christian.
Be relied upon.
Nor is it very Christian anymore.
Or had there been in the past. Yeah. But nonetheless, those who directly have a stake or familial even in the Israel-Palestine disagreement mm-hmm. certainly is growing in Europe and certainly has had an effect on European attitudes. One more thing I'd like to add about a positive development, about people who spoke out, which something very important was the speech that Lawrence Summers, the president of Harvard, mm-hmm. made in September of 2002, in which, very unusual, he was a Jew, he was the president of Harvard, he didn't have to address this issue, but he addressed what he called the progressive communities on campuses in America and said that
all those post-Marxist lefties who are professors of sociology and English who are very actively and adamantly anti-Israel.
Yes, and he said basically at a certain point this kind of virulent anti-Zionism tips over into anti-Semitism in effect, if not intent. And you see that on some American campuses even, where I publish an email from someone at San Francisco State where Jewish students were physically attacked by, quote, anti-Zionist, unquote, students.
And it's happened on more than one
and
campus.
And I've visited campuses. I have also an essay by a Yale student about the thunderous roar of approval for Amiri Baraka mm-hmm. when he read his poem accusing the 4,000 Jews of staying home from the World Trade Center and the Mossad masterminding it, that sort of thing. You know, it's not
but
entirely...
But man is the poet laureate of New Jersey. Isn't
yes. This is not entirely absent from American campuses, and many Jewish students, and I've visited campuses, actually feel threatened here in America.
At the University of Chicago, where I've labored for many, many years, many of the Jewish students feel the same. And last year, they organized a sort of protest and insisted on seeing the administration and talking about the way in which there was some such anti-Israeli presence on campus, most strongly and directly represented by some of their professors who were bringing it into the classroom.
You know, you hear stories about that over and over again. And again, the intellectual bankruptcy of this position, the double standard. I mean, I have what I think is a really important essay in the book by Jonathan Friedland, mm-hmm. who is a lefty and writes for The Guardian in England. And yet he lays out very rigorously the double standards of the anti-Zionists and says that, well, if you believe that no people should move into another territory occupied by other people, okay, fine. Then you must believe that America itself has no legitimacy, because America was founded by people who moved into a land that was already occupied by other people. So are you saying...
What nation was that?
The Indian nation.
No, but I mean, in the whole history of the world. What
yes,
nation?
Exactly. Yes, and if you believe that you know a group of people are not allowed to have their own identity, there's this nation, the Sikhs, the Pakistanis, the Indians. They're all divided on religious grounds, and yet Israel is the only one that is singled out for opprobrium for that. So it's the intellectual bankruptcy of it.
I think there's a template laid down long ago in history, anti-Semitism long before there was Israel, and the kind of anti-Judaism, anti-Jewish sentiment, which is 2,000 years old, or maybe it's older, provides a basis which can always be aroused.
I think that's, maybe that's the answer, although I wouldn't let professoriate that you're speaking of off the hook that
easily. I would not at all. Indeed, the question arises, why can't you be a leftover lefty, which many of these guys are, and still essentially responsive to the reality of Israel, the desirability of Israel's presence?
I think...
There was a time when they were. At the time of the immediate establishment of the state
of
Israel.
Someone said that, you know, the Jews always got a lot of sympathy from the left when the Jews were victims.
Yeah.
But as soon as the Jews actually had a state of their own, it had to defend themselves and had to use military power to defend themselves. Suddenly, the Jews were evil.
We have some commercials that are due, and then we do want to go to the phones. At the moment, I see all the lines are taken. Perhaps one line is available. 591-7200 is the number. If you try to get through and get the busy signal, the proper strategy, of course, is to try again in a few minutes, and especially after we say goodnight to some prior caller. The other alternative modality available in virtually infinite supply, whatever virtually infinite means, is email, the email address extension 720@tribune.com. Directly on to your contributions after this. And we will go directly to the phones. 591-7200 is the number, and you are on the air. Good evening. Hello, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Milt, very interesting show, and I'm somewhat nervous. I've never called one of these shows before, but I wanted to call because I wanted to ask the general question if you and your guest feel it's possible to be critical of a policy of the State of Israel and be critical of certain actions that Israel as a country has taken without being anti-Semitic. I mean, I don't feel that I am anti-Semitic. I believe that in Israel's right to exist as a country and all of that, but I'm very troubled by some of the policies and actions that I've seen Israel put in place and take over the years. And I'm also troubled by the fact that I can criticize our government and things that we do, and I'm allowed to do that without being labeled. But if I criticize Israel, there was an op-ed piece in most of the national papers, and I can't remember exactly who wrote it, but this person made the case that if you criticize Israel, it's anti-Semitic to do so. And that's very troubling to me because I think we as a free people should have the right to criticize without being labeled that way. Three specific policies or actions that I am critical of are, one, what I view as, and I think the world views as collective punishment, demolishing homes, destroying olive groves, that kind of thing. Two, rather than taking the most powerful army in that region into Gaza or the West Bank and arresting a person that Israel feels is a terrorist, Israel has rather taken the position of assassination through helicopter gunships, which I agree with your guess that they are targeting the terrorists, but they must know that in an area so crowded as Gaza and the West Bank, that if you fire one or more missiles from a helicopter at a car, that you're bound to kill bystanders who are not terrorists and are innocent. And the third policy has to do with the settlements. I just believe that Israel has continued to expand these settlements with the idea of expanding their territory. I don't see any other explanation for it, because if they're talking about defendable borders, it seems to me that the borders become much more indefensible the more it consists and includes settlements in what was until you know, fairly recently, someone else's land.
Well, sir, you convey all of that articulately. Let's begin to get some response from Ron Rosenbaum.
Well, I think the caller makes a good and crucial distinction between criticizing Israeli policy and criticizing Israelis' right to exist. I mean, I think that that's the distinction that we all ought to start with. I think that, however, it gets more complex once you get into the question of what does Israel have to do to defend its right to exist, and why does Israel have to defend its right to exist? I think one of the most important pieces in my anthology is by Amos Oz, who was a founder of Peace Now, the Israeli dovish anti-settlement, anti-occupation movement. No one more critical than most Israeli governments than Amos Oz. But he has faced reality, and what he says is, well, it would be great if we gave up the settlements, and we had a two-state solution, and we could live in peace, but he now realizes that it's unlikely that any such settlement will end what he calls the Muslim holy war against the state of Israel, against its right to exist. So when you're facing an enemy that doesn't want to make peace, that doesn't want to negotiate, that walked away from the table, that basically denies your right to exist, then it's a different situation. You're fighting for your life, and the odds are against you. And I agree with the caller that there are questionable actions that have been taken, but they're actions that have been taken by a state that really is in peril of its existence.
I think an imperative question is, a question of fact, is whether in the Arab world or the Muslim world generally, we find any people of some influence and some intellectual or political pertinence who in fact speak publicly, write publicly, about the necessity for finding a compromise settlement and finding and speak critically of the extremist relegation of Israel to prospective extermination.
Well, unfortunately, you know, there was a New York Times interview with the one of the leaders of Hamas back 2 years ago, and he said, you know, we're not interested in a two-state solution. We're interested in one Islamic state in which we may may permit the Jews to live.
But that's Hamas, but surely there must be
something
else in the Arab world.
You say there must be, but I'm not seeing it. And the ones who have spoken out in that direction are generally killed by their own people.
I think there is a sentiment in the conciliatory direction and in the non-apocalyptic direction, but it is indeed intimidated by the murderous force of the various activist movements, the various militarized movements.
Well, unfortunately, you know, that seems to be the reality on the ground, as they say.
Years ago, when I was a kid assistant professor at Yale, where you also went to school, I had a good friend. I think I won't give his name now, but he came from Syria. He was a graduate student in philosophy. He went on. He wrote critically in those days of the anti-Israeli mood. This goes back a long time ago. And he went on going back to his native country and to other teaching as a guest professor elsewhere in the Arab world, advocating realism rather than extremism with regard to the presence of Israel. And he's had some people that he's been in communication with. They've got a rump group of one kind or another. But he's also served some time in prison for his views.
Well, you know, I was thinking further about what the caller said about anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. And what's interesting is, I mean, yes, there's a distinction between criticizing Israel's actions and its right to exist. But there's also something that I'm hearing, maybe not in him, but in others, is a singling out of Israel. I mean, there is genocide going on in the Sudan now. Hundreds of thousands of people are being slaughtered.
an Arab aristocracy or an Arab majority, Islamic in religion, and the people they're slaughtering are blacks in the South who are animist or Christian.
Right. And where is the world? So Israel has fires a helicopter gunship missile, and the whole world is down on its case. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of people are being slaughtered. No one breathes a word. Why is that? Why are Jewish crimes singled out for the spotlight of the world? And that's not just in the Sudan. I mean, all over the world, there are vicious, murderous regimes torturing people in their prisons and murdering them right and left. The spotlight never falls on them. The spotlight seems to fall only on this one tiny country fighting for its existence. And it's there where I think anti-Zionism shades into anti-Semitism.
Well, as I suggested earlier, I think there's a template that was laid down a long time ago. The Jews somehow are especially available for rage, if not contempt,
yeah.
Or envy, if not sorrow. I quoted to you earlier a little bit of doggerel. I didn't remember who put it down, but it's a fellow named William Norman Ewer, who was 1885 to 1976. He lived a good long life, and he said, "How odd of God to choose the Jews." So it's a Christian rejection of the Jews as the chosen people. Cecil Brown, the well-known British Jewish commentator, answered, "But not so odd as those who choose a Jewish God, but spurn the Jews." But that's the crucial issue, which goes way, way back. Mel Gibson has helped us to remember it yet once again.
Mel's great contribution. Mel's movie is now playing throughout the Arab world.
Being well received in the Arab world.
And I wonder why.
Yeah. We must pause for a quick round of commercials, then directly back to the phones. 591-7200. And once again, our guest for the evening has been and continues to be Ron Rosenbaum, the regular columnist at the New York Observer. I often put some of your Observer columns up on our blog, on Milt's File.
I've seen that. I'm very pleased.
Well, I always read them with great interest and profit from them considerably. And he is the author of the book of some years ago. Was it about 10 years ago now?
Not that long ago.
Explaining Hitler?
Explaining Hitler came out in 1998, actually.
98. It's only 6 years ago.
Yeah.
We had a great time discussing it.
Yeah.
And I've often mentioned it on this program. Is it still in print?
Yes. Translated into 10 languages
it's
as well.
It's a wonderful book. He is the editor of the new book, Those Who Forget the Past, The Question of Anti-Semitism. Random House, the publishers. We go back to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening.
Yeah, one might ask rhetorically, why should the Palestinians negotiate when all they have to do is wait? By 2015, Israel will be a majority Palestinian nation. By 2040, they'll be a majority of Palestinian citizens. I don't think the Jews in Israel stand any more of a chance than the Pied Noir did in Algeria.
Let's go back on that. By 2015, Israel will be what?
There'll be a majority of Arab residents in Israel.
Do you mean in Israel as it is presently structured or in historic Israel?
In Israel that includes the West Bank and Gaza.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as I said, I'm a pessimist. I was attended a conference recently where someone suggested that if the Israeli government was smart, they would start giving tax breaks or whatever to people who had, you know, more than one or two children. You may be right. You know, I look down the road. I don't see any happy ending for this situation. And that's a big heresy in America, where you always have to feel that there's a solution to a problem. And I'm not seeing a solution that that is anything but I don't even want to say it.
I think the parallel to the Pied Noir in Algeria is very apt. Things got very ugly there with, you know, the measures of the French becoming ever more repressive and the Arabs simply sitting still and taking it until the French finally had so outraged world opinion they could no longer stay there.
You may be right.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
Certainly.
Demography is something that's kind of hard to argue with.
You know, I think that's somewhat behind. I'm not really an expert in the current strategy of the Israeli government, but I think that's somewhat behind the strategy of withdrawal from Gaza and what Amos Oz calls a demographic border, reconfiguring Israel so that it will be a majority Jewish state, and it may end up giving much more land back to the Palestinians than they imagined in order to do so. But I guess that's one solution.
Of course, the Israelis hoped, some of the leading Zionist officials over the long years hoped to get much more of an influx, continuing influx, of Jews immigrating from elsewhere in the world.
Well, they did get about a million from the former Soviet Union.
That was the last big immigration.
Yeah, and, you know, it's hard to say, come to Israel, build a future at this point.
We go back to the phones, 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Milton. Enjoy your program and clearly agree with much of what your guest has said. However, I have several comments that I'd like to add to the mix. And one, being myself a survivor and a council member of the United States Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., I just can't buy the pessimism that he espouses. And clearly, I don't deny the serious nature of the growth of anti-Semitism worldwide, or the fact that the Palestinian issue is a difficult by all stretches of imagination. Nevertheless, I know that in the Jewish darkest hour, at the height of the Holocaust, or the depth, however you want to phrase it, a young man named Hirsch wrote the anthem that became the watchword of the Jews in the ghetto, which was Zug nicht kemel, as the Geistem letzten Weg. In other words, never say you're going on your last walk. We at the museum get 2 million visitors a year, and every one of them leaves with a better understanding of what the Holocaust represents, what genocide is, and I think it changes the viewpoint of many, many children that come there. So, to me, if we could have hope in the darkest hour of our history, we certainly aren't in the darkest hour of our history at this moment. And I just don't buy. I think I'm with Golda Meir that pessimism is not a luxury Jews can afford. Finally, I'd like to add one more element to the discussion, and that is that this Bush administration has probably been the most accommodative to the point of view of trying to preserve and save Israel from its situation, and I think Jews should be ever mindful of that.
Well, I would like to believe that the work that you and the museum are doing will, in the long run, prevail. Believe me, I don't feel good about being pessimistic. I long to find some reasons for optimism, and you've given me one possible reason for optimism. I wish I could see it, but this is America, you know, and America is a different place from the Middle East. We don't have suicide bombers. We don't have Iran close by with nuclear missiles within its grasp soon, if not now. We don't have 300 million people who believe that the Jews should be driven into the sea. So,
yeah, well, we had a Nazi army that was an all-conquering Europe Nazi army, and those words and those sentiments were not written by an American in America. They were written in a moment in time in Poland where, death was imminent, and death to the entire Jewish people was imminent.
Well, it's a beautiful song and it's a beautiful sentiment, but you know what you're saying comes close to the people who I hear say Hitler lost the war. Hitler didn't lose the war. Hitler killed 6 million Jews.
I'm confident that I understand that, nor do I need the lecture on that. What I'm pointing out that is if Jews accepted your pessimism, then I don't think there will be a solution. I think it's
so. So what do you think should be done?
Well, I don't have a solution. If I was, I'd be...
You don't have a solution,
however,
and you're an optimist,
I'm an optimist based on the Jewish people.
Based on some guy wrote a song?
Excuse me. That song was written 5,000 years worth of times. It's been written time and time again during one Holocaust or another, during one misfortune or another. And it's the sentiment of the Jews to somehow prevail and survive. If I had an easy answer to it, I'd be glad to give it. There isn't. But certainly it isn't despair. And I would just suggest that you'd not be as pessimistic and not be willing to accept the fact that there will be a solution.
Well, I think if Ron Rosenbaum were fully pessimistic, he wouldn't have put this book together, nor would he have done the earlier very valuable book explaining Hitler. Sir, I thank you very much for the call, and we must go directly to the newsroom for an update on the weather situation from Paula Cooper. And we return to Ron Rosenbaum. Back to the phones in a moment. Let me read you, Ron, an email that's come in. I have been listening to your program tonight, and I'm very interested. It's fine with me that Israel exists, and I really don't have any problem with anyone based on their religion, because in most cases I know it is an accident of birth. I do understand why I am more interested in what goes on in Israel than what goes on in Sudan, and that is because it affects me and the U.S. more. Many Arabs hate us because we as a country are Israel's staunchest ally. Whatever actions the Israelis take reflects back on us as a country. To some extent, the events of 9/11 are due in part to our support of Israel. There's a crucial sentence in this little essay. I'll read it again. To some extent, the events of 9/11 are due in part to our support of Israel. Like it or not, we Americans are somewhat selfish, and the events in Sudan do not affect us in the same way. I would like to make one more observation. I do believe that the American people of the Jewish faith have much more of an allegiance to Israel than any other group has to their ancestors' homelands. My children are of Irish, German, Italian descent, and I'm quite confident that they will have much less of a concern about these countries than their Jewish classmates in college will have toward Israel. If I have any feelings towards people of the Jewish faith, I guess I wish I knew that they have the same commitment to the well-being of this country first that I do.
Well, there are so many things in that email to comment on. I guess the thing that I would like to pick up on is that we should be so concerned about not about doing the right thing, but whether or not the Arab countries like us. You know, we should be so concerned that we support a democracy that shares our values in the Middle East, the only democracy in the Middle East, which it seems to me is something very American to do. And the person who sent the email seems to suggest that that makes us unpopular, and we should never be unpopular. We should never do the right thing if it makes us unpopular, and I just disagree with that.
And let us go directly back to the phones. Time is short, and lots of people are lined up waiting. Here's the next. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, Milt. I have one thought that I'd like to make, and that is, as someone who was born and raised in a Presbyterian family, my perspective is that those of us who grew up inside the church got a picture of the Holocaust, and I'm 61 now, so it's been a while, a picture of the Holocaust in Europe that froze our image of anti-Semitism as just that. And so it's very hard to leap over that and see that the kind of scapegoating that happened to Jews in the 30s and 40s is so similar to the kind of scapegoating that's done to Israel these days. And I'm thinking back in particular to the late 80s when the Iran-Contra events happened, and as soon as they were exposed, the first thing the White House did was say, oh, that was those Israeli arms merchants, when it was really happening in the basement of the White House. And fortunately, that idea didn't take off. but that's one of those examples of blame it on somebody else rather than take responsibility.
I think that's a very good point. I think that whenever something goes wrong, you will find someone who will try to pin it on the Jews as a very convenient scapegoat.
And the other piece is that I think that as a non-Jew, the primary responsibility for ending anti-Semitism is ours, because we're the ones who perpetuate it.
I couldn't agree more with the caller because, as someone said, anti-Semitism is not really a problem of Jews. It's a problem of, if you want, Leon Wieseltier said, if you want to study racism, study whites, not blacks. If you want to study anti-Semitism, study the anti-Semites, not the Jews.
Thank you, sir, for the call. Of course, it must be noted that lots of people who would say, in response to what you're saying tonight, but I really am anti-Zionist. I really am not anti-Semitic. Truly, some of my best friends are Jews. The concern is with the actions of the ruling elite of Israel rather than with the Jews as a people.
Well, you hear that all the time, and there's a very interesting essay I publish in this anthology by the philosopher Beryl Lang, and it talks about, must we believe people or take them at their word when they say they're not anti-Semites? Sometimes it's true, but sometimes if you look at the consequences of what they say, and if you look at the what the beliefs that they express would actually lead to in terms of the fate of the Jewish people, perhaps one doesn't necessarily have to take at face value their self-satisfied, self-congratulatory declaration that they're not anti-Semites.
What does it cost you to do the Hitler book and not to do this? By cost, I mean emotionally.
I spent about 10 years doing the Hitler book, and I suppose in some ways it was less costly than this book because that was in the past. I mean, it was costly. I mean, it was it took a lot out of me and left me a wreck at the end of it, and, studying the hideous ugliness of Hitler and his co-conspirators was ghastly. But I thought when I finished that book that in some ways I'd left this in the past. And in doing this book, I only spent a year, it felt like 10 years, putting it together. But it was really I can't at all compare myself with people who are real victims, but I have to say, if your job 24/7 is reading the literature of anti-Semitism for a year, you don't get off lightly. It just is the most. I feel bad. I sort of apologize to the previous caller who defended optimism and that song and all that, and maybe my downbeat appraisal just comes from having spent a year wrestling with this and feeling terrible about the situation.
It will be good for you when you get back to the book that you abandoned temporarily to do this one.
I'm two-thirds through a Shakespeare book. I have 170,000 words. I've counted them, every one of them, and practically, well, I did it, I love doing that book, and I thought that would be my escape from Hitler, but
of course, you still have the problem of The Merchant of Venice,
which I think is an irredeemably anti-Semitic play.
Oh, really?
Alas, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And
how do you finesse that?
I don't finesse it. You can say that Shakespeare is somewhat more advanced than most people of his time, but on the other hand, there's an argument that Merchant of Venice is even more anti-Semitic in some ways. But on the other hand, I think I've listed three hands now, it was the only evidence of anti-Semitism, and it was not, it wasn't as if Shakespeare was a hater.
It's not as bad as Marlowe's Jew of Malta.
Well, I'd almost say it's worse than Marlowe's Jew of Malta, because that's almost a comic book Jew villain in Jew of Malta. And Shylock, in some way, by giving him more depths, he makes him more, you know, worse in a way.
Well, anyway, get back to it as soon as you can. I think you need us.
I do.
It's been a great pleasure having you here once again, Ron.
Thank you. Our
guest has been Ron Rosenbaum. The book we've been drawing from is the one he's just edited with a brilliant introduction as well, titled Those Who Forget the Past, The Question of Anti-Semitism.